Folks, it is time to talk about one of my absolute favorite topics, snacks. Japanese snacks, specifically. You know, ever since I was a young lad who discovered the world of Japanese snacks, I've been obsessed with their adorable packaging, quirky vibes, and the incredible flavors that you just cannot find in U.S. supermarkets. That is why teaming up with our sponsor, Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been an absolute blast. Because these snacks aren't just your average grocery store finds. Every month, Boxu delivers over 20 unique treats straight from Japan. Plus, they include a handy guide filled with info about each snack and Japanese culture. Snacking and learning, literally my two favorite things, and I'm going to take a wild guess that those are two things you enjoy as well. Oh, and did I mention that each box ships free from Japan straight to your doorstep? It's incredible. And these snacks are so special, okay? One of them that I just cannot get out of my mind, they have this white chocolate strawberry. It's like a freeze-dried strawberry that is somehow injected with white chocolate. So it is both simultaneously strawberry and white chocolate. I cannot even describe to you what this tasted like. I have never had a textural or taste sensation like it. You gotta try it. And my favorite thing about Boxu, besides the amazing snacks, is that they support small, family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced your treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love Japanese snacks as much as I do, or if you know someone who does, you have got to try out Boxu. Right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. And let me know what you think of that strawberry. It is seriously good.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I don't know the truth. I don't know the way. I don't know what to think. I don't know what to say. Yeah, but that's alright. Yeah, that's okay. I don't know anything.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Factually. My name's Adam Conover, and let's talk about language. You know, the linguistic invention I'm using to communicate with you right now through this microphone. Look, it goes without saying that words have meaning, right? But they don't always just have the obvious meaning you see in the dictionary. The words we choose and how we use them spray a thick fog of association and connotation around us, and they can reveal hints about our age, our social class, or even our ethnicity. I like to think of the words I use, for instance, as the clothing that I wear. Depending on my word choices, I could be wearing the linguistic equivalent of ripped jeans and a t-shirt, or a tailored three-piece suit, or JNCOs and a fedora. Pretty sure the word m'lady conjures the image of that last one into your mind, doesn't it? The point is, there is no neutral use of language. When we speak, or when we write, or when we text, our words are telling stories about us, regardless of the specific thing we're trying to say. Here's an example from my own life. I am, in general, a really ingratiating emailer. Maybe you're like this. All of my emails end with, either way is fine, whatever you want to do is good with me, right? I don't want anyone to be mad at me. So I tend to make sure my emails come across really nice and light, right? But that's a problem for me because in the last few years, I've been in charge of making a few television shows. And as uncomfortable as I am with the idea, I'm a boss. And in a professional setting where I'm going back and forth with some powerful network executives, for instance, being so ingratiating is kind of a bad look. So last year, I made a change. I decided that from now on, I was going to stop using exclamation points in my emails. Cut them out completely. We're going with periods. No more exclamations. and it had an instant effect. The effect was it immediately made me feel more confident, adult, and mature when I wrote those emails. You know, saying, sure, will do, with an exclamation point sounds chipper, but adding a period makes it sound matter of fact. It becomes, sure, will do. Getting rid of all those exclamation points made me feel less needy. No longer was I trying to cheer somebody up with my email or make them feel extra positive about, I don't know, my email about script notes or whatever. I still use exclamation points with my friends or my parents, people who I want to communicate friendliness and enthusiasm to. But in work emails, I find if I get rid of them, I can adopt a certain steeliness, which is useful if you need to get things done, which I often do. Losing the exclamation point has given me the same feeling of confidence I get when I dress up a little bit, right? I'm trading my linguistic beat-up hoodie for a business suit when the occasion requires. The point is, the language we use can change the way we feel about ourselves and how people feel about us. And in fact, language is so powerful that it can even change how we perceive the world. One study found that perceptions of color differed based on people's native language and the way those languages categorized color. Another study found that people's perceptions of time could actually change depending on the metaphor their native language used for time. Language shapes us in profound ways, and it is so complex that we are constantly discovering more about this thing that we use all the time. It's just like the ocean, something that we're still plumbing the depths of, except that it's in our own minds and our culture. Take the internet. It's transformed the way that we use language, and it's created totally new contexts and forms for us to communicate in. With the internet, we're communicating more than ever, with new rules and new meanings, and we are still discovering how those new changes are affecting the way we speak, the way we think, and the way we conceive of ourselves. And to talk to us about that today, we have the ideal guest. Gretchen McCulloch is a linguist, podcaster, and writer who's the author of the book Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language. This conversation was so fascinating. I had an incredible time talking to her. I can't wait for you to hear it. Let's get right to the interview with Gretchen McCulloch. Let's just start the conversation here because I want to make this point. I can't stand looking at myself while I'm on a video conference, and I can't believe that the default is to show you your own video because it makes you completely neurotic in a conversation. Because when are you talking to other people in real life and also constantly looking at yourself? It makes you...
It's like being at a bar with a mirror. Like sometimes you go to a bar and they have a mirror. Back when we went to bars and they have a mirror and you're like, oh no, I'm just sitting here just like looking at my teeth. Like, do I have anything in my teeth the entire time? And
yeah.
Sometimes what I do or what I suggest that people do is get like a sticky note and just manually attach it to your screen to block your own video of yourself.
I mean, yeah, because if I don't do that, I'm just constantly looking at myself, like getting, what's my best angle? Like, you know, are my glasses on right? Like da, da, da. It's bizarre. It changes our behavior. And it's just one example of the many ways in which the internet changes our behavior. This segue is sounding too practiced, but I... But you're a linguist and you research how the internet changes our language.
Yes.
Give me some examples of that. How has it done so?
Well, one of the things that I'm really excited about that, you know, especially before the, you know, tremendous rise in video content, which I think if they ever give me a second edition and I get to add another chapter, I might have started video, but
the paperback with a bonus chapter.
We didn't do that because the paperback came out quite quickly. But if you know, if we do a revised edition in 5 or 10 years, I've always, because the problem is like I'm sure there are several people who are currently writing like their PhD dissertations about TikTok or video streaming and video conferencing.
Yeah.
They haven't been written yet. So I have a strong interest in video, but not a lot to cite. And so the thing where I do have stuff to cite is on how we communicate with each other in text and how we use informal text and informal writing in the online context in a way that's sort of, you know, different and exciting and interesting compared to the sort of traditional, like, oh, you know, you learn how to read, you read books, other people have edited these books, and it's a very sort of formal context. So how we write now is a big question that I'm trying to figure out an answer to in Because Internet, because it's, you know, we're doing a lot more writing than we used to do as a society, and we don't even think about it, you know?
Yeah. And it strikes me that we're talking about language and linguistics here, but like,
I feel like there's an easy way to pigeonhole that and say, oh, that's just like, oh, what kind of grammar do people use, et cetera. And that's fun to learn about, too. But what we're really talking about is the internet fundamentally changing the way we communicate and therefore the way we behave. It's like, you know, when the printing press was invented, once people began to be able to, you know, write these long form works, people started to spread ideas in a different way. It started to think in a different way, started to act in a different way. Like, it changed the new communications technology, changed not just our language, but the shape of human society because of how the language changed. And so this is a very big, fascinating conversation and topic.
It is a big conversation. And what's interesting about looking at internet communication in terms of informal writing is that you can also find pre-internet precursors to it.
Mm.
So one of the things that I find really fascinating is looking at things like postcards. I looked at a bunch of archival postcards when I was writing Because Internet. And what's really fascinating is if you take them and you type them up, they look like texts from your grandma.
like what do they say?
They've got like the dot dot dots between the sentences, or like all of these hyphens, or like, you know, dear so and so, like, hope you're having fun, dot dot dot, we're at this place, dot dot dot, you know, love so and so, XO. And sometimes they have little doodles in the corners, which you could think of as sort of precursors to emoji, because people did draw on things.
Yeah,
that's so strange. It had little happy faces or hearts or these kinds of things. The XX, that's very common in British text messages. A lot of British people will end their text messages with an X, is also there in the postcards. And
wow.
This is a thing that people keep cornering me over, is why do these older people in my life, my parents, my grandparents, my boss, why do people use this dot, dot, dot? And you can find precursors of it in postcards. So
wow.
What this generation is actually doing is importing norms from a different medium to something that's kind of similar.
Cool.
But in a digital form. Yeah. Like, they're not just sort of, because this is a big question for me is, right, so how is it that a bunch of people's parents and grandparents and so on who don't actually use the internet that much, how is it that they're all doing the dot, dot, dot thing? They're not talking to each other. Like, they're not getting it from each other online, because most of them are communicating with like their younger relatives.
Yeah.
They're not getting this dot, dot, dot. And it seems like one of the answers is it's because it was this thing offline that they're just importing into a new communicative context.
Wow. But there's a mismatch there, right? Because to me, when I see a dot, 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 it means something very different than maybe when they write a dot, dot, dot. Like, when I see a dot, 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 that means like trailing off, like a lack of interest or boredom, or maybe you died halfway through the sentence because you fell down a bottomless pit, or something like that. And so it's very rude and weird to write.
Or kind of a something left unsaid. Like, if you mm-hmm. say like, yes, dot, dot, yeah, dot, 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 that's, I'm indicating that I'm leaving some sort of reservation here. I'm leaving some sort of, I have
yes.
some reservations that I'm not expressing them.
Yeah. So I'll see you there at 3 dot, dot, dot. It's like, will you really? Or are you going to do something to me horrible when you get there? What
right,
is with the dot, dot, dot?
Like,
ominous.
You know, do you want to meet up tomorrow? And you're like, I could dot, dot, dot. You're really trying to say, actually, I'd rather not.
Right.
And where that comes from. So there's a linguistic, principle of analyzing not just what people say, but also what they could have said in that context and what they chose not to.
Mm.
And looking at sort of what the possible alternatives for what someone could have said and what they chose not to say in a particular context. And in this case, what's relevant is our idea of defaults and our idea of what's the sort of default break between a message. And for younger people who have been sort of, you know, acculturated online, the default break between a message is a new line or a new message. So you might send several texts in a row, and each of those message breaks is a new message, or you might have some line breaks, and that's the sort of default spacer if you're of an internet native generation, because line breaks are really cheap on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And new messages are really cheap in text terms. This
yeah.
wasn't true in paper. Right? You can't just put a dozen line breaks in a postcard because you'll run out of postcard.
Yeah.
Or if you're leaving someone a note on like a post-it note or like a note on, you know, note by the kitchen table or like note on like a, Remember when people used to leave like notes by the telephone when like so-and-so called, they want you to call them back.
Yeah, we had a little, we had a little special chef. This is like a chef. It's weird that I described it as a chef. It was like a little notice board in the shape of a chef, and it had a roll of receipt paper on it, so you could leave an infinite note on it. And I'm only remembering this because my mom just sent it to me, sent a photo, and was like, "I'm gonna throw this out." And I was like, "I remember it, so don't. No, never mind. Throw it away. We don't need this anymore." It was just like it's a relic from the past of this specific thing to write notes down by the telephone.
And so there's two things there. One is that, you know, people used to write notes on pieces of scrap piece of paper, little piece of paper that were supposed to specifically like narrow or smaller. And line breaks weren't free in the same sort of way.
Yeah.
Line breaks were expensive. And so instead of leaving a line break, in order to indicate a sort of casual break between thoughts where you don't necessarily want to commit to, is this a full sentence? I'm going to put a period there. I'm going to put a comma there. People would put either a dash or dot, 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 because those are punctuation that kind of split the difference between is this a full sentence or not. They can be used for both types. You see this in poetry, like Emily Dickinson does this in her poetry. She has dashes all over the place. Mm. You see this in these postcards. There was some old recipe cards that I found that had like dot, dot, dot between each of the steps of the recipe. And it's a way of sort of indicating a casual break between thoughts, exactly the way that you or I might use a line break. But in a more sort of casual way. And that's what this older generation is trying to do when they're putting a dash or a dot, dot, dot. And the thing is that for these younger generation that's using line breaks or message breaks as their sort of default separator, that means that the dash and the dot, dot, dot have the potential to take on other types of meaning.
Mm.
And so you start looking around and being like, well, what else could, what could someone mean with a dot, dot, dot? Because it can't mean it's a default message break because we already have one of those. What else could it mean? And then you start thinking, oh, maybe it's trailing off, or maybe it's something left unsaid, or it's sort of a pregnant pause, or any of these sorts of things. You start inferring other type of stuff from it. And because you talk to people who use dot, dot, dot by default, and they're shocked and horrified that this is what they could be expressing, right? Because for them, it's like, this is just my default spacer. It's like if somebody told you every time you send like enter on a new line, you're sending this message you never realized. You're like, oh my God, no, it's just a new message. Like, come on, guys. It's just what happens when two, but either of these norms are totally fine by themselves. It's just what happens when they start like running into each other as this sort of norm train wreck.
Is there something also with older folks? And I'm not trying to harp on older folks here. I'm many older folks listen to this podcast. I love you, older folks. Mom, if you're listening, I love you. But I am going to call you out right now. Because do they just maybe also not pay as much attention to how their language works? Like, I am on text all day and I'm sort of constantly calibrating for the person I'm talking to. But my mom will just text me. She'll text me, Adam, all on one line. Call me. All on one line. And that's such a hot, it's like a red alarm. It's like the alarm went off in the submarine. Bah, bah, your mom is dying or she's mad at you. And I'm like, Mom, what? And she's like, oh, I just wanted to ask you if I should put this chef notepad on eBay. I'm like, all right. Well, that was such an extreme use of that. Is there that kind of mismatch as well?
Well, I don't want to overstate this because I think to some extent it's very easy to look at another group of people and say, you know, they must not be thinking about them, what they're doing, because they're not doing what I'm doing. And if I were thinking about it, I wouldn't be doing that. And you get that reductivist discourse a lot when we're talking about, you know, younger people, like, do the youths just not know what they're doing? And so I'm hesitant to say, well, the olds, they don't know what they're doing. In the same way, I'm hesitant to say, well, the youths, they don't know what they're doing. Because it's not like, oh, I have the monopoly on being right and everyone else is just not thinking. That's, that seems like a very sort of non-charitable attitude to have towards everybody who's not like
what's up. Fair enough.
What I will say is that there are older people who have told me this, that they think that text is sort of fundamentally incapable of conveying these sorts of subtleties, or at least that if it does, that's a thing that like professional writers do. And that if you as an ordinary person want to convey emotional subtlety, that's why you would pick up the phone. And so this idea that voice has this sort of advantage over text in being able to communicate emotional subtlety, and that you don't need to think that hard about how you're doing communicating in text because text just isn't capable of that meaning. And of course, and I think to people who do think that text is fundamentally capable of it, that means that if you're not thinking about it, you're still getting off messages. I don't think it's strictly speaking an age split. I think it's age combined with how long you've been on the internet. Because there are people who are now what you would call older people who have been online since the 80s, maybe even since the 70s, been using computers for a long period of time. And they're like, no, I have the old smileys that we used to use back in the day on like this system. Like we used to do this on Usenet. We used to do this on wherever. And people who've been online for a long time definitely think that text is capable of having this type of subtlety. But people who are a bit older and also weren't early adopters at the time, back in the day when one could be an early adopter, whereas these days everyone just kind of gets things at the same time. It's not just a question of age, it's a question of having defined yourself as a non-technological person for so long. To speak like a particular group of people or to talk like a particular group of people, to want to adopt the characteristics of a group of people, it means that you have some sort of interest or respect or affection or, you know, positive sentiment towards that group of people. And so if you don't have a positive sentiment towards being online or communicating with technology, you also don't think of yourself as a tech person, even though you've now been using, you know, computers and so on for maybe a decade or so at this point, or more at this point. But you still think of yourself as not really a tech person, which means you don't really feel like tech-ish features of language are yours to use.
But you're still using them. Like the way that you put something you said just a minute ago reminded me of a conversation I had like a decade ago with a college friend. We were talking about clothes, and he said, this friend is like, you know, a t-shirt and cargo shorts guy, you know, and he was saying, Adam, like, I don't care what other people wear, and I don't care what I wear. When I'm dressing, I'm not trying to say anything. I'm not trying to communicate anything about myself. I just don't care. And I was like, well, hold on a second. That you are communicating something. You're communicating that you don't care. I can tell that from the way that you dress. Like, you can't opt out of the system of clothes saying something about you, even if you don't understand it. The very least you're going to communicate is, I don't understand what my clothes are communicating, because people are going to be like, oh, this person is they're dressed in a confusing way. And I feel like your use of language would be similar.
Right. And I think, you know, you do have people who are saying, I'm not going to try to adopt, you know, the trendy thing that the youths are doing. I'm going to communicate like I swallowed the AP style book. And you're still communicating something about yourself that way.
Yeah.
You know? Or you're going to communicate like, you know, in this style of using dot, dot, dot. I'm going to communicate like I'm not a tech person, or I'm going to communicate like I'm, you know, I refuse to use emoji because I think I am too good for them or something. You're still saying something about yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that there's been an interesting, the people that are like the most discomfited by Because Internet, which I think is great because they get to be very comfortable for all of the other language books. the most discomfited are the ones who said, but I communicate, you know, like I've swallowed the AP style book. I communicate like I'm in this very formal style. And I have this whole time. And you're telling me that this thing that I thought was neutral isn't actually neutral. And what it says about me is that I'm uptight. And I'm like, yes. Yes. If you refuse to make typos in an internet context because you can't possibly let anything go out of your, you know, go out of your hands without, you know, double and triple checking it, you are definitely communicating that you're uptight and you're maybe a little bit judgy of other people. And if people don't like that, that's kind of a reasonable response on their part.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you can't do it.
It completely depends on the context. Like was asked to be more involved in a nonprofit that I'm was semi involved with, and they asked me to join their fundraising board and stuff like that, right? And one of the things they said to me was like, Adam, we thought you'd be good at this because your emails are really good. When you reply to us, they're like really well written, and you know, I've like adopted like a very professional email style with them, right? But then on my group DM about like basketball, it would be very inappropriate to write that way. They'd be like, what is this weirdo doing in, you know, our basketball DM?
Right. And I think that, you know, this is something that we do in speech all the time, is we communicate in different ways with different types of people, right?
This is the fabled code switching. I've heard of this.
This is the fabled code switching. This is the whole, like, you know, you don't talk to your dog the same way you talk to your boss, or at least I
wish
so.
I did.
Who's a good boss?
That's the other way around. Yeah, I want to talk to my boss the way I talk to my dog. Who's a good boss? Who's got some work for me to do? Who's got some work? Oh, you want me to do it, don't you?
You want to go for walkies? We're going to have a one-on-one at the park.
Wonderful.
So, you know, we talk differently with different people, and we don't think there's anything weird about this. You know, we don't think that there's something wrong with this or something weird about this. We can talk differently with different people. And I think that can also be true for writing, especially because we're writing in so many more contexts than people might have written 50 years ago. You know, there was this sort of postcard genre, but it wasn't as common as the amount of times you can tweet or text somebody. A lot of those would have happened in speech before. So this idea that, you know, we're writing in different ways and you can write differently in emails than you do in, like, you know, group chat with your friends or whatever, that's fine. That's great. You don't have to. What I like about when people have read Because Internet, they're like, oh, I was already using internet slang, but I felt bad that I was doing it, and now I feel okay about myself. And I'm like, this is great. I like this response. I feel bad about using slang or about, you know, talking differently with different groups of people. It's okay. You're okay.
Now, it's amazing to me how fast language changes over time. Like, I was recently, I forget what the context was, but I was noticing how even in, like, the 80s when people wrote letters to each other, like, business correspondence was so much more formal than today. Like, today, business correspondence has, like, this, you know, it actually has a little bit of casualness to it a lot of times, like people emailing each other within a company, right? But, you know, in the 80s, people were still writing, like, you know, Mr. So-and-so, I read your article of June the 28th with great interest, or, like, that kind of thing. And, like, nobody writes like that anymore. And
it's kind of like everyone wearing The Office or something. It feels like it's gone alongside with, like, oh, you know, now you have your dark wash denim or whatever that you wear to the office, or you have your, like, you know, your dress up yoga pants, or, like, your formal t-shirts that you wear to the office.
If you wear a tie, you're the weird guy at the office. Like, I literally remember wearing a tie to my job at College Humor one day and feeling so uncomfortable and awkward and, like, getting made fun of. I was like, what? Like, why am I doing this?
Well, it's still a type of uniform, and it's still a type of expectation, right?
Yes.
Because if you address someone, your email to somebody, you know, dear sir, I hope this letter finds you in good health. You know, like, I read with interest your article of May. I think you're like, who the heck is this guy? Why is he so formal? You know, it's just like wearing a tie becomes a more marked behavior. There's still a sort of, you know, it doesn't mean that there isn't a sort of still an set of expectations, just because those expectations have shifted.
Yeah, there are. It's just a different set of norms. Like, something I think about a lot is, like, I follow a lot of journalists on Twitter, and journalists are, like, out of every profession, like, the most on Twitter. And there's a certain sort of accepted use among them of, like, Twitter language and, like, joke making that, like, certainly wouldn't have existed in the 80s. Right. Like, you wouldn't have had all these sarcastic journalists publicly writing little snippets.
It did exist in the 80s.
OK.
Which was something that I was really interested to encounter when I was researching Because Internet, was this genre of Xerox lore and fax lore.
This is so exciting. I don't know what this is, but I'm so excited to hear about it. This sounds like this is my shit right here.
Right. So you may have seen some of these from, like, maybe your parents or something like that. And this was, people would repeatedly photocopy or fax to each other, other offices, things like political cartoons, like jokes, running jokes, various types of just, like, cartoons in general, and often sort of commentaries on office life. They'd often be, like, tacked up on top of above the photocopier. As, like, here's this funny joke. I found this funny cartoon. My friend sent it to me, who works at this other office, sent it to me. Now I'm going to photocopy it. I'm going to share it with, like, 20 of my buddies.
Yeah.
Like, here's this thing that's really funny. Or, like, I'm thinking of the kinds of things where, like, you know, so-and-so arrives at the pearl, like, a lawyer arrives at the pearly gates and says, blah, blah, blah. Like, those kind of stock jokes.
Street jokes is what we call them in comedy.
Those are memes. Those are proto memes. They're memes.
I can't believe I literally smacked myself in the head. I can't believe I never made that connection, that memes are street jokes.
And they're, because they're templatic, like a meme. Like, yeah. You have a Pearly Gates joke, or you have a, you know, like a lawyer and a doctor and a whatever walked into a bar joke. Like, you have the walked into a bar joke, you have the professions joke, you have, you know, some that are not, you know, particularly sensitive, you know, blonde jokes and all these sorts of, like, you know, racial stereotype jokes, which are terrible. They're still templates, though, and it's not that memes don't also sometimes do that.
Yeah. It's really funny. I remember talking to my girlfriend Lisa a while ago because I was frustrated. I was like, man, Twitter sucks. It's just people repeating the same template jokes over and over again. That ain't it, chief, just like that over and over again. And then she was like, yeah, except the cool thing is the best people make up a new one and then everyone else copies it. And that's like sort of the being like the fashion influence, not influencer. That's being like a being of the fashion designer of sentences, right? Well, where you come up with a new trend.
And people were repeating templatic jokes before we called them meat.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, you make a new, and a lot of people, like, they'd retell, you know, my grandfather always used to have one of those, like, page a day joke calendars.
Mm-hmm.
Remember those? The page a day calendars?
Yeah.
And they would have these, like, jokes that were, like, kind of original, but kind of not, and just, like, mostly extremely plagiarized from who knows where, because, like, you can't copyright a joke. And he'd, like, save the best ones and, like, share them with us when we would visit him. And this feels like having, you know, having a Tumblr in the early 2010s. Where you're like, I've got to reblog all my best memes so that people can see them and appreciate them.
Well, and that's exactly the same behavior before social media in like 2005. I was more online than most of my friends, and I had a folder on my hard drive where I saved all my favorite meme images and videos. And when friends would come to my dorm room, I would show them like on a slideshow of memes that I had collected from parts of the internet they didn't know about. And then like that, of course, just like, you know, that was completely obviated by Reddit and everything else. There's like no reason to do this anymore.
Right,
but
you have like these chain email forwards.
Yeah.
Like, remember, you know, forwarding people emails like, here, you know, here's a bunch of jokes about like cute things that like funny things that kids have said or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, here's this thing. I remember, you know, there was the dancing baby one, the dancing baby gif, or like there was like a penguin that pushed another penguin into the water gif. And people would email them and they were like, you know, so and so would be like your friend who always found the funny emails and like sent you them. And then so and so would be your friend who didn't send you very good funny emails and would send you them anyway. But this was a kind of social currency of like, oh yeah, we're going to forward these around. One of them that I encountered, you know, in back when email forwards were cool, like late 90s, early 2000s, I think this is, was, so it's this one that's like in mock German and it's about a computer and it's called Blinkenlights. And it's like, you know, this is sort of very bad fake German of like, you must not touch the Blinkenlights. Don't, this is fancy machine. Don't touch it. But it's in bad German. It's like clearly designed to be legible for English speakers. And when I was writing Because Internet, I actually was like, wait a second. I wonder where this came from. How old can we trace it back? And this has been traced back to World War II.
Wow. It's been passing around and then eventually made the jump.
And then eventually somebody typed it up, or possibly several people typed it up. It traces back to this, there was a sort of mock German doggerel style that hung in Allied machine shops.
Yeah.
In World War II, where like, of course they're mocking the Germans because like they have this, you know, obviously enemy relationship with them. And, you know, like blinking lights and fancy machinery doesn't have to just be the computer. That can be like earlier kinds of fancy machinery as well, whether it's a telegraph or something. And so there's this sort of connection.
Yeah.
Of one of the examples that gets cited a lot in the meme literature, because like, of course there's a meme literature.
this is every cool online grad student's thesis right now is on meme literature.
It's on meme literature. So one of the examples that gets cited a lot in the meme literature is Kilroy Was Here, which was like a handwritten sort of chalk meme that people would, you know, people would draw this face with the nose peeking over the wall and write Kilroy Was Here. And that was like the thing that you did, kind of like now if you see the number like 69, you say nice and you just say that, you know, people just would just write the Kilroy Was Here thing like, oh, there's a wall. I'm going to write that on it. But I think the rate of change of memes in this or jokes in this early sort of proto space is slower because the rate of communication itself is slower.
Yeah.
Like on Twitter, you can have a meme that becomes a meme for like one day. Like I think we're recording this on the same week as the 1 year anniversary of the, you know, 30 to 50 feral hogs meme, which right. really took over Twitter for one day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And then people, and don't even try to say it the next day. People will be like, what the fuck are you doing bringing around the feral hogs to my timeline on Friday? Fuck you. That was yesterday, idiot.
That was yesterday's meme. Or sometimes you show up. Like, I remember this is a number of years ago. You remember when The Dress, you know, took over the internet for a couple of days? Everyone remembers that. That
Loved
day,
it.
I had happened to be taking a nap, and I woke up. And in the previous, like, 2 hours or whatever, I went back online. The previous, like, 2 hours, suddenly everything was about this dress, and I was just so confused.
It was so intense. I was hosting a live comedy show that day, and me and my co-host Emily Heller we were like, okay, let's talk about the dress in the show. And we're like, so everyone, we want to talk about this. And then we put up a screenshot of the dress, and the whole audience started screaming at once. They all went, blue, gold. It was so funny.
Had opinions about it.
And it wouldn't have happened the next day. The next day, we would have been bored of it.
Yeah. But I don't think you can get this kind of speed with the Kilroy Was Here meme.
Right.
Or even speed with, like, you want to say, like, the early lolcat memes. Like, when you go back and look at the early lolcat memes, there are, like, a handful of them that are your canonical lolcat memes. And they're the same one everyone knows. Everyone knows I Ken has cheeseburger. Everyone knows I made you a cookie, but I ate it. You know? Yeah. And they lasted for years. That's so long.
Yeah. Yeah.
They lasted long enough to be a canon text, and there were so few of them, because so few people had, like, graphics editing capability to make new ones.
That's a really good, I never thought about that. You're right. Like, lolcats lasted for like 5 years or so. And now, like, if you go to like a meme Instagram account, nothing lasts that long. It's just like the internet screaming insanity, like constant chaos and change.
And some things do come back when they get mashed up with other things, right?
Yeah.
You know, like the nobody meme. The kind of nobody joke template where you have like nobody colon blank. And then, you know, I say something that's, you know, nobody asked for. That's been kind of just percolating along kind of under the radar. And it gets sort of brought back when something new happens.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets kind of brought back and remixed with stuff. So sometimes like the, you know, like the faster something rises, the faster it descends as well. But sometimes something kind of simmer away in the background for quite a long time as well. It's interesting for me thinking about what, like, because we have, even compared to, you know, 10 years ago or 12, like before, if you compare this to before social media enabled things to spread as quickly, you're relying on like, okay, you know, someone has to forward me this email so that I can see it. And then I have to forward it to someone else. Whereas you can disseminate things faster. You have like big meme accounts, whether that's on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, like BuzzFeed picks it up or something, and that can disseminate it to a much faster audience.
Yeah.
And make a meme really like take off very quickly and therefore like subside very quickly. The interesting thing I think about memes and like where they're going is so there's also been a shift in the last 5 years or so from interior monologue captioning memes to object labeling memes.
Mm-hmm.
These are the terms that Know Your Meme uses for them, and I think they're good.
Yeah, okay. So, internal monologue. Okay, wait, yeah, break this down for me,
please. Yeah, let's break this down. So interior monologue captioning memes, a lot of them are animals, but they're not necessarily the text on the meme. So if you think of a meme as an image, which they're not all images, but like if we think of a meme as an image for a sec, there's the text on the meme represents the interior monologue of the character in the meme.
Yeah, I Ken has cheeseburger. That's what the cat is saying.
I Ken has cheeseburger. That's what the cat is saying. Or the you know, the Shiba Inu is like such something. Wow. And like that's implicitly what the dog is saying.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The same thing like the entire advice animal genre. That's implicitly what the animal in the advice animal is saying. And then you get this switch. And one of the early well-known memes in this switch is the distracted boyfriend meme.
Mm-hmm.
So the distracted boyfriend is not saying anything.
Right.
The distracted boyfriend is labeled in a relationship with the girlfriend and the other girl he's looking after.
Yes.
And so there's this switch from that the entities in the image of the meme are implicitly talking to the entities being labeled.
The meme as a metaphor or an analogy for a different relationship, where we have a meme that means a relationship between three things. Thing A is more interested in thing B when it should be interested in thing C. And then you can apply that to any real world situation, which is a lot more complex of an idea than just a cat saying, "I can't has cheeseburger," where the joke is cats want cheeseburgers.
Well, it's a complex idea, but it also relies, it's more versatile, adaptable to different subcultures.
Yes.
Because there isn't just one meme culture now. Like there may have been, disputably, there may have been at some point a single Unitarian meme culture. There isn't now. We can say that.
Something that we used to do on the College Humor Writer Slack to amuse ourselves was find hyper-specific memes from subcultures that we didn't understand and share them with each other. Because it would be like, you know, that feeling when you're taking the bar exam in Alabama and you're, it was like just these really long thing or about like memes that triathletes would make to each other about their training schedules and share on Facebook accounts. And they're always fascinating to look at because you can recognize it as being a meme, but you have no idea what the fuck experience it's talking about.
There have been linguistic specific niche memes since at least 2011 was when I started being aware first of linguistic specific niche memes. But like that was mostly because I knew enough linguists at that point that I was exposed to them. Maybe they were around earlier as well. Like maybe there were linguistics versions of locuts that I just didn't see. But so, you know, there is a certain amount of nichedom that's been around for a while. So what's interesting about, so the object labeling style starts out as an image meme thing. You have the distracted boyfriend who gets labeled, or you have the, like, is this a butterfly? Or is this a pigeon when it's actually a butterfly?
Right.
And that's a relationship of three things. It's like a person asking, and then an entity, and then a question that's bad. But you also get, this is a kind of meme that you see a lot on TikTok these days, where you have the meme text, the thing that was the picture in an image meme, is the audio track.
Yeah.
And then the person who's in the picture is often labeling themselves or characterizing themselves as different entities.
Yeah.
So maybe they're putting on different hats, or they're putting on different wigs, or they're putting on, you know, fake makeup and various types of things, and they're being, you know, like me and then my chemistry teacher, like, does this thing to me or whatever. Or they're putting on, like, sometimes they're holding up captions, like, written on paper, you know, so they'll be like, you know, study, this is a lot of, like, you can tell when it's like kids studying for like their AP history exam season. Because it'll be like, I don't know, you know, like America, the British. Well, like this.
They're making a meme about what they're learning in school.
Absolutely.
How wholesome is that, you know? Who's going to complain about that?
It's really wholesome. They'll hold up a piece of paper, or they'll write that text on the image itself with like, you know, various video editing tools that you can use. But the idea that the common thread that the meme template gets based on is this audio file, rather than it's this image and then you add more text on top of the image. That's one of the interesting things that I think like TikTok has done to the meme genre.
Okay, we got to take a break. Every time I'm about to take a break, you say something fascinating that I have to reply to. And then we go back and forth. And now my producer's going to be mad, or at least ad sales are going to be mad, because we got to take a break and listen to some ads. But we're going to be right back with more Gretchen McCulloch. I have a huge question for you after this. So stick around. We'll be right back with more Gretchen McCulloch.
Folks, I'm honored to say that the podcast is sponsored this week by The Washington Post. If you're a Factually listener, you're already a person who aims to stay informed, aware, and engaged. But let me bring you in on a little secret. Beside the fantastic guests I have on this show, the number one way that I stay engaged is through reading the news like The Washington Post. Their journalists bring you the facts and provide clarity about what's happening on Capitol Hill, the economy, climate change, foreign policy, and everything else that I and you care about. You know, here on Factually, we love to go deep on topics, and the Washington Post helps me and helps you go deeper on the news that matters most to you. That's why I start my days by warming up my brain by reading great articles from some of the best journalists out there in the Post. In fact, many of my favorite past guests on this show, like Taylor Lorenz and David Weigel, have contributed to the Washington Post. That's how good their journalists are. You know, I've also found that adding the Washington Post app to the home screen on my phone has been a great way to cut my social media time. Instead of scrolling through social media on the bus, I get to learn more about the world around me. It is absolutely incredible and makes that commute time so much more enjoyable and fruitful. I also love the Post's newsletters, like The 7, which is a quick commute read that they send each weekday morning and is also available as a podcast. I even signed up to get the Post's For You newsletter, which sends me my very own personalized roundup of stories every evening based on my interest in reading history. So if all of that sounds good to you, well, now is the time to sign up for The Washington Post. Go to washingtonpost.com/factually to subscribe for just 50 cents a week for your first year. That is 80% off their typical offer. So this is truly a steal. Once again, that is washingtonpost.com/factually to subscribe for just 50 cents a week for your first year. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. You know, I never used to have allergies, but then suddenly in my 30s, I started getting walloped with them every single spring. I'll step outside on a beautiful day, ready to hop on the bus or head down to the podcast studio, and suddenly I have a runny nose, scratchy eyes, and it makes it pretty hard to have a conversation with our guests when I am so bogged down and distracted with allergies. Well, luckily for those of us who live with those symptoms, which now includes me, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. So when I've got a big interview with a big guest, I look for relief with Claritin D. In as little as 30 minutes, I'm refreshed, I'm renewed, and I no longer sound like some kind of cartoon duck. So if you are ready to live life as if you don't have allergies, it is time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. You can find Claritin D at your pharmacy counter, and you don't even need a prescription. So go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. That's Claritin.com. Use as directed.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, Gretchen, I have a question that I think about a lot, and I apologize if this is a little bit like spacey, like, you know, big picture, like we're smoking weed during grad school kind of question, right? But, you know, I think a lot about, you know, there's been so much change in human society, not just society, but like the way humans as a species operate in the last 10,000 years, right? You know, if you look at human history, we were, you know, basically pretty advanced apes for like millions of years, right? And then around, you know, you know, I'm not a historical anthropologist, so it's, I don't know the exact date, but, you know, things started accelerating, right? Like the amount of change that's happened in humanity in the last, you know, couple thousand years is much greater than what was happening before. And that looks like that comes along with the development of language, with the development of culture, and that you start having this process of like cultural evolution, right? That starts happening in our minds, as opposed to just like, instead of just genetic changes, you have cultural changes happening as well, and they start iterating on each other and creating these feedback loops. What you're describing, where like, okay, now linguistics are the way we use language is changing faster and faster because of the internet, starts to make me think, well, is that sort of process like, is that, is there something that's fundamentally speeding up about the way that humanity is on Earth? I told you it was a really smoking weed on the porch during grad school question, but.
So there's the three different things there to unpack.
Yeah.
One is that language is actually very old. Language as a human capacity, whether it's spoken language or sign language, is really old. And as far, we don't know exactly how old because unfortunately, like sound waves and hand signs don't leave fossils.
Mm-hmm.
If you hadn't noticed. So we don't know whether it's more like 50,000 or more like 200,000. That's approximately a date range for how old language is. Writing is much newer.
Mm-hmm.
Writing is a technology.
Right.
Language is a human capacity. Writing is a technology.
Mm.
And it's a technology, like we've never encountered a human society that doesn't have language.
Mm.
And they're all really complex. You know, there are about 7,000 languages that linguists have cataloged these days. They're all really complex. They're all really interesting. They're all fully fledged languages by whatever metric you want to define a language. Writing is different because writing is a technology. And because it's a technology, it can be transmitted, it can be lost, it can be adapted, it can break.
It can be saved.
It can be saved. And it can be, you know, so, and writing, you can, it's a much easier also to track how writing spreads because, of course, it makes physical records in at least many cases. If you're writing on wood, it might not last super well because wood rots and so on. If you're writing on stone, it's great. So writing is a lot more recent to that. What writing lets you do is it gives you, on the one hand, it gives you a more durable way of communicating with the past and with the future.
Yeah.
Because communicating with people in the here and now is still, you know, fairly easy, but communicating, whether that's with your past self, because you're writing yourself a note to remind yourself the next day to do something, or whether you're communicating with like the state tax collectors to be like, yes, I've paid my taxes. Here is the goat that I gave you or whatever. Writing gives you this ability to communicate across displacements in time and displacements in space. And that's one of the reasons why in many cases, you know, societies that encounter writing, they're like, oh yeah, that sounds like a cool idea. Let's borrow that for us. But mm-hmm. it sort of spreads gradually in this sort of diffusion sense. And then there are also places where, you know, like the Romans were really keen on writing. And then, you know, after the Roman Empire collapsed, there was a lot less literacy. There was still some literacy, but there was less literacy overall. People were learning Latin just to kind of gain access to the writing technology because the writing technology happened primarily in Latin,
mm-hmm.
Which you can think of in the modern age as like people learning English to gain access to, you know, communications technology.
Yeah.
Because
that was what all the books were written in. That was like what the medium of the written technology was all in Latin at the time.
Right. I mean, why learn Latin to write Old English? Because there wasn't much there to read in Old English. You want to learn Latin so you can read, Caesar or something.
Yeah.
The same thing of like, if you want to code these days, a lot of programming languages are based off of English.
Yeah.
And there's no intrinsic reason why they have to be based off English. Like, you know, if you have a command for bold or italic or something, why that has to be based off English mnemonics.
Right.
Rather than it could be based off Russian. It could be based off Japanese. It could be based off any language. There are a few programming languages that are based off other human languages, but this vast majority of them are based off English. And I wonder
never
if that's
thought like, of that. Yeah. Like they're all saying, dominance. Yeah, they're all saying go to line 10. Well, that's very dated code, but yeah, they're saying go to 10 or like, if
or like
then they're not saying the equivalent
world.
They're not saying the equivalent in Mandarin.
Right. And like, you know, Mandarin has words for if, I assume you could use that word, but it becomes this sort of prerequisite of like, oh, like it's really easy if you're an English speaker to be like, oh yeah, here's, of course you're going to have like a body text and a, you know, header text mm-hmm. or something like that. Because these are words you recognize even if they're used in a specialized sort of way. But like, imagine this isn't even a script you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And you have to learn a new alphabet and then you have to like learn this mnemonic. I wrote an article about that, about programming languages being based off English for Wired. And it's like the one that I got the most both positive and negative comments on.
Huh.
Because I had a lot of people being like, yes, finally, thank you. Thanks for saying it. You know, this is This is a thing, especially for children learning how to code and something. And then I also had people being like, well, they should just learn linguish and blah, blah, blah.
Well, yeah, I mean, of course, those people are just looking for an article to write that in response to. Learn English! They're just people driving around America looking at people to yell learn English at.
But yeah, it's very interesting. But you can, when you make the Latin analogy, because it seems strange to us as English speakers in, you know, the 2000s, say, to be like, why was everyone so keen on learning Latin for so long? And it was because it was this, but it's the same reason that people these days are keen on learning English.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gives you access to this particular type of internationalized global discourse and gives you access to this particular type of technology.
It was the learn to code of, yeah. of the Middle Ages.
A good reason, because maybe people should have access to this in their native languages as well. But
yeah.
That was a reason why people learned, were so keen on learning Latin for so long. But just to get back to writing being a technology.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not a historian. This is not me being a historian. One of the hypotheses that I like, and I got this from the historian Ada Palmer, who's also a sci-fi writer, is this idea that as the speed of communication increases, that's what makes change happen faster or seem to happen faster. So like the faster, you know, if it takes a letter 3 months to arrive from one corner of the Roman Empire to another,
yeah,
then the speed of change of things that can change is constrained by that 3 months of like how fast can a person with a horse transmit that
right.
letter, or a person in a boat transmit that letter.
Right.
And that's assuming they even have a letter, they have writing as a technology, which lets them send the exact message the person wanted to. Otherwise, you're sending a messenger and you're telling this messenger, like, memorize the message that I want to send, which
yeah.
people did. Memorize this message that I want to send. They had memory techniques for a lot of these things. And then arrive at this place 3 months later and recite the message that I wanted to send them. And then memorize the message the other person wants to send and, you know, come back 3 months later. So you can have change potentially happen faster when people are able to communicate with each other faster.
Yeah, and you're talking about change in the ways that people are using language or changes in how the language develops.
Change in anything, but especially the sort of broader reaching societal change. So,
oh, okay.
You know, like if you want to say changes in fashion, right? So if you want to know, oh, how are the cool people dressing over there? You need to find out what they're doing first in order for you to do it.
Right.
Because if you don't know how the cool people are dressing over in Paris or whatever, you can't then mimic them. If you only find out how they've been dressing in Paris like 3 years later, your fashions yeah. are always 3 years behind Paris.
So when you're watching, I just watched a whole lot of Jane Austen movies, and they're always going mm-hmm. like, oh, the new fashion in Paris is hats. And they just found out because someone just came from Paris to like the little London country town that they're all living in, English country town. And so that means that sort of like puts a limit on the rate of speed at which fashion changes. But today, where we're all doing it on Instagram and
right,
you're seeing
so
it instantaneously.
Right, someone in Paris takes a selfie, puts it on Instagram, and I'm like, oh, hey, look what they're doing in Paris. Right. So if I wanted to, I can be aware of what people are doing in that sense. And even if you think about meme diffusion, like we were talking about with chain emails, like if the fastest way for me to find out, like, hey, there's this cool GIF is for like someone who I happen to know personally to email it to me.
Yeah.
Even if they can email it instantly, the fact that I can choose, oh, here's this funny person who posts a lot of cool GIFs, I can go follow them on social media somewhere. I can find out about the cool GIFs at source rather than wait for them to arrive like three email chains later. Even though the technological communication happens instantly, it still has to go through people somehow.
Yeah.
You know, how does something become viral? It goes through people somehow.
But so this actually affects like how fast fashion might change. Like the faster the communication happens, then fashions themselves might change faster.
In theory, but there are other things that slow things down, right? So there are also things like fashion, like supply lines and
mm-hmm.
you know, how fast the fashion industry like plans its seasons in advance. You know, how fast can your manufacturers copy this other thing?
Right.
You know, how fast can they gear up to make something? You're still going to be looking at months or, you know, sometimes longer for how fast can anything happen? It's still constrained by like atoms in the real world. The other thing though, is that technology, because of communications technology, and this is true of writing as a technology and also of the internet and like, you know, computers and so on, is that it can also be a force for conservatism in the other direction, because you have the records of what people were doing. And if you're the kind of person who doesn't like change, it gives you more ammo to say, let's not actually change it. Right? So you have, for example, like, you know, after the Roman Empire falls, you have Latin evolve into the modern Romance languages, French and Spanish and Italian and so on, right? And that's happening. That change is happening because change is a constant. There's never a period when there's like, oh, well, there's no change now.
Right. Humans language is always changing. Just like if you're trying to stop it from changing, it's a fool's errand.
Well, it's like, I mean, it's the same thing as anything, right? Like, you can't just stop a river from, like, eroding the banks a little bit. Or, like, you can't stop, like entropy is a force in the universe. You can't stop change from, like, humans grow up. You know, this is a thing that happens. You can't stop your kids from growing up. So you can have the ability to look back and say, oh, here's what people were doing back in this generation. I'm going to learn this word that was older. I'm going to keep remembering this word that was older. So on the one hand, you have like Latin splitting off into the Romance languages. Cool. So that's change that was happening organically, especially because they weren't communicating with each other anymore as much. And so they were able to develop these more distinct local dialects, they're able to look back at the sort of classical Latin and keep looking back to it and keep drawing things from there and keep borrowing things from there and try to reverse the course of some of these changes. So in some cases, people added in silent letters because that letter had been there in Latin.
Mm.
So like the English word debt, for example, came from a French word, which was also debt. And it was spelled D-E-T-T-E at the time. Mm-hmm. Debt.
That seems and more then, appropriate.
Seems more reasonable, right?
Yes.
And then some people looked at Latin and they're like, oh, this word originally comes from Latin debitum, where they had pronounced that B. In the internet sense, we can see technology also makes us more conservative because of things like spell check.
Yes, spell check. I keep it off all the time. I don't ever want spell check looking at what I'm saying. Having a little algorithm looking over my shoulder, like not understanding the things I'm writing, terrible.
I mean, it's useful sometimes. Like, I use spell check, especially on your phone. It makes you type fast. You can type faster when it's predicting the words. But at the same time.
Well, that's autocorrect. That's different.
That's autocorrect. Oh, okay.
I don't like the little red line. I hate that.
But all of these, autocorrect, spell check, predictive text, all of them are training, like they're helping us write words the way that they've previously been written.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's like you type a new word, you type some sort of like jocular respelling, and then spell check like thinks that you want to use it all the time. Like my phone now thinks I always want to write actually with a capital A. Because I've done that like sarcastic, actually good at, you know, turns out sleeping is actually good like one too many times. And now it's like, would you always like to be sarcastic with your actually? So I'm like, no, not all the time. But the general principle of things. So if you're talking about like the silent B in debt, which like if we had a more decentralized writing system, we could one day stop writing that silent B. There's no reason for it to be there.
Yeah.
But because our phones are, you know, helping us, quote unquote, helping us, you know, write things in this way that they've previously been written, it reinforces all of these sort of weird fossilized spellings that, you know, arrived one day, and it makes it actually harder to change things as quickly because you have the phone like helping you be more conservative with respect to spelling.
We have a force sort of pulling us back from the big changes that we might otherwise make, or keeping us on the straight and narrow, like sort of keeping things mainstream a little bit. So I'm curious what you think about, you know, the idea of correcting each other, right? Or language staying the same. This is, I feel like, the first question like linguists get asked a lot of the time is prescriptivism and descriptivism and this sort of debate. I did an interview with Anne Curzan. You know Anne Curzan?
Oh, yeah, she's great.
She's wonderful. She was on my older podcast, Adam Ruins Everything podcast, and on the show. And she used this great example of, I've been corrected my whole life for saying, you know, how are you doing? I'm good. Instead of I'm well. Mm-hmm. And you should say I'm well. Like my friends in college would say this to me. And she was like, that's wrong, because I'm good means something different than I'm well. Right. Like I'm good means like I'm doing good. Like I'm good. Like things are good with me. As opposed to like, I am in good health. You know, it's like it has a different meaning. And so I feel like we often have this rejection of, I loved that argument, right? Because I'm like, yes, fuck all those people who tell you how to speak, right? Who say that this is how the English language works. We should really just be describing how people use it in practice and allowing it to change because that's natural, da 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 da, right? But is it also the case that these forces keeping us on the straight and narrow are helping us communicate by sort of standardizing our language a little bit? Or how do you view that as someone who like is exploring the wilds of internet language or languages it's most chaotic?
Yeah, well, Anne Curzon, actually, it's funny that you brought her up because she makes this argument in her book, Fixing English, about how she asked a bunch of her colleagues who were, you know, English professors and so on, where do you think Microsoft Word gets the words that are in its spell check? Like, what list do you think it's pulling from? Where did it get its ideas of what is good grammar or bad grammar or what is a word or what isn't a word? And they were like, huh, I've never really thought about that. And, you know, if English professors who question words for a living haven't thought about it, what hope do the rest of us have? Like, where are the kinds of things coming from? And so I think, you know, the idea that we should be looking at language how it actually is and not trying to make people conform to some sort of abstract idea of correctness, this is really the least controversial idea in linguistics. Like, I go out, you know, on like radio interviews and people are like, wow, what an interesting, bold idea you're advancing. And I'm like, no, I don't think you understand. Like, this is this is like the first lecture of Lingua 101 type content.
Yeah, but that's among linguists, not among English teachers, right?
Right.
Who, not among like grade school and primary school teachers who are very much, you know, I think a lot of people have had the experience of being hovered over with a ruler while they're writing and saying, no, you wrote wrong, you know?
Right. And it is definitely still very common in education. And a lot of people internalize that, and they internalize that they're somehow, you know, a better person because they're very persnickety about language. And I think that there has been a trend away from that, especially a lot of people saying, look, you know, maybe I'm going to do this one thing in essays or on a resume or something, but I'm going to do this other thing with my friends and that's fine. And I think it's, you know, there are a lot of things going on. They're going on there. And I think this idea, like, it's not necessary to correct other people. Like, if you go around correcting other people, you know, when they haven't asked for it, that makes you an annoying person.
Yeah. You're being a bad person when you do that because it doesn't fucking matter.
You shouldn't be surprised if people don't like you because you're actually just being an asshole.
That's like going up to someone with a clothes metaphor again. It's like going up to someone and saying, your clothes don't match.
Like, I don't like your shirt. Like, who asked you? You
know, yeah.
If I bring you in as my fashion consultant and I'm like, all right, you know, like, tell me what I should be wearing for this fancy event. Like, I want your opinion. Then you give my opinion. If I don't ask you what you think of my clothes, or even if I, like, if I bring a friend to the store or something and I'm like, hey, you know, what do you think about this shirt? Should I buy it? I've asked you for your opinion. But you don't go up to random people in the street and be like, I hate your shirt.
Yeah. And as a corollary to that, some people don't say that to individuals, but they'll just complain about, I hate when people use the wrong form of your. They say your instead of your. It's like, this is really bothering you, like, all day long. Like, you know what the fuck they meant.
That's like having a rant about jeggings. Like, what did jeggings ever do to you?
Right.
You don't need to have a rant about jeggings. It's fine. You don't have to wear them.
You can have your opinion, but why are you wasting your breath talking about it?
Well, I'm like, why? Like, other people want to wear them. Like, it's fine. You don't have to wear them. I think the other thing is that there's, like, linguists also need to exist as people in the world. So as academics, we can say, hey, we want to analyze everything. Let's just figure out how everything works. But existing as people in the world, the kind of ethical standard that I like to think about for me is, am I using this, you know, form of language to try to connect with people, to try to, like, be friends with people, be kind to people, be polite to people? Or am I trying to use this to be, in, like, sanctimonious and annoying and, like, to prove my moral superiority over people? So if you're going around with, like, a red pen and apostrophe, you're using that because you're trying to prove your superiority over people. But if you're going around trying to use people's correct pronouns, that's because you're trying to connect with them and be polite to them and be nice to them. That's I'm trying to prove my intellectual superiority. That's, I want to respect people. So, you know, there's a question of, like, you know, why are you doing this? Are you doing this, you know, because you're trying to be a decent human to other people? Or are you doing this because you're trying to make yourself feel better and, like, you know, put other people down? And so I think that saying, like, oh, well, this is wrong because we didn't used to do it this way. Like, what has that apostrophe ever done to you? But, like, not using slurs sounds like a good point. You know, that is in some respect also prescriptive, but that's prescriptive in the favor of like being respectful to people, which I think is good.
Yeah. I think about crossword puzzles. I really like doing crossword puzzles, and mm-hmm. crossword puzzles like rely on a certain shared understanding of how language works, of like what words mean what. And like, you know, like I'll do a crossword puzzle and be like, you know, when I read the clue, it limits the number of answers that could go in, because I'm like, no, they wouldn't use that word that way in that clue. So the answer is probably this. Right. Mm-hmm. And so you need a certain amount of, you know, guidelines or guardrails on the side of the road in order to make the puzzle possible. But at the same time, it's a format that's fundamentally about playing with language, about finding new uses for language. And the best crossword puzzles are the ones that like, radically introduce new words and new, new forms of speech and include internet speech and that sort of thing as the language is actually spoken. So it feels like there's a healthy, like, yes, we need a common frame of reference, but then we're using that in order to be expressive and have fun. That's what the common frame of reference is there in the first place for.
Well, and I think like, if you think about this point of English as a lingua franca, you know, a lot of people learn English as a second language to communicate with, you know, sort of the broader world of English speakers, whether that's first or second language. And yeah. There are ways in which people who are English native speakers are some of the worst at doing this, because, you know, we talk too quickly and we use too many idioms that are like obscure vocabulary words. And in some cases, it's easier for people who both speak English as a second language to communicate with each other than it is when you have a native English speaker going in and being like, oh yeah, like here are all these things that you didn't need to know in order to do this sort of level of communication. So, you know, are you actually trying to accomplish communication? Because communication is about meeting somebody where they are. And it's about both people or everybody involved in the situation trying to find some sort of common ground, and not like saying, well, the way I do things is objectively right, and so you all need to be doing this, and all of the common ground is my common ground, right? So I think adapting the way we talk to different contexts, you know, there are certain idioms, you know, that I know are Canadian that I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to use this with Americans because they're not going to understand. You know, you can have this sort of sense of awareness of like, what am I doing that might not be understood internationally, or what am I doing that, you know, I'm deliberately trying to, you know, index a more Canadian identity in this particular context.
But
it requires this sort of awareness of other people, but that doesn't mean that, you know, the previous thing that we thought of as sort of an unmarked default, that got created by a very particular set of people, right? That didn't just like appear.
Right.
So where is that default? Who creates it? And, you know, how can you sort of both validate all of the ways of talking while also trying to have people, you know, somehow meet in the middle or meet at a place where they can understand? It goes back to this question of like, well, why learn Latin? Because it gives you this access to this.
Yeah.
This community.
This goes back to what you were saying about how people respond to your book and they say, oh, I thought I was speaking in the default, and you're saying I'm actually communicating in a way that's kind of uptight. Mm-hmm. And I certainly also feel that I speak in the default. And by the way, this is like, or that's what I felt throughout most of my life. And this is really emblematic of like white culture in America, is like the belief that, no, this is the default. What everyone else does is weird. But what you're pointing out is that like, no, these are all just different contexts and different frameworks, and they're value neutral. They all exist. And if you are privileging one over the other and saying, no, this one is the neutral and is the right way, and everything else is weird, you're actually making an error, because you're going to fail to communicate with people in the proper context. I think about like what you were saying with second language speakers. And I've noticed myself sometimes when I'm speaking to someone with English as a second language, I'll change the way I speak in a way that like, I'll just use simpler syntax and stuff like that. And that's me. I used to think, that's me like making an effort to communicate more clearly.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, like there are a lot of people are very self-conscious about like, if I change the way that I talk with other people, does that mean that I'm like parroting them, or does that mean I'm making fun of them? And you don't want to end up at so far that you're.
That was what I almost said. That was like my concern is like, oh, am I doing like a voice here that I shouldn't be doing?
But I think so much of this is so context specific, you know, like linguists like to say that everybody has an accent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just like, oh, those people have accents, and people who talk in the sort of majoritarian way, we don't, quote unquote, don't have accents. I mean, if nothing else, you have an American accent. If you talk to a British person, they're like, no, you have an American accent. But you know, everybody has an accent. Everybody has ways of talking that are different. And the question is, you know, at a societal level, we've chosen to privilege some accents over others. But that doesn't mean that there's an intrinsic feature. Like, nobody had a beauty contest for accents of English tried to find them. There's a really interesting study, actually, where they looked at, they had a variety of accents in Britain, because, of course, there are lots of British accents.
Yeah.
And they have different people in Britain believe different things about them. They have different sorts of associations, but those associations don't always cross the Atlantic. So they had a bunch of British accents. They played them for Americans. And they asked the Americans to rate them on various qualities of, you know, pleasantness and attractiveness and, you know, how cool of an accent this is. And the Americans found the Birmingham accent like the best. They rated that one the most highly. And the interesting thing about this is, if you say this to a British person, they're like, what? Because in Britain, the Birmingham accent is specifically stigmatized.
Yeah.
But the Americans who came in without knowledge of the particular social features that were assigned to this accent were like, no, this accent's great. It's lovely. We really like this one. This is the best of the British accents. So none of these features are intrinsic to, like, the consonants and the vowels and the intonation and all of these like granular linguistic features that you're producing. They're all imposed from society. You know, like, jeggings are morally neutral.
Yeah.
Like, it's just who you associate.
It's just pants.
The kinds of person who wears jeggings or who wears, you know, sunglasses or who wears any of these types, you know, cool jeans or non-cool jeans or whatever.
Yeah. You don't hate jeggings. You hate young women. That's basically what it comes down to.
You hate young women. You don't hate vocal fry. You also hate young women.
I mean, everybody hates young women, and it's very everyone's making that very clear.
it's this like weird, funny coincidence, except it's like completely not a coincidence that like all of the language versions that people dislike also happen to align with all of the various groups of society that people dislike.
Yes.
You know, like, people dislike African Americans, people are racist, like, oh no, now they're going to stigmatize African American English. That's not a coincidence.
Yeah.
That's like, it's the same thing.
Yeah. It's like entirely it's the social value of the way of speaking that people are putting onto the way of speaking rather than some high-minded concern about linguistics or something like that.
No, because like linguists will tell you, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
You know, like, here are all these interesting features, and like, you know, every dialect, every language, every accent has its own interesting features. And you can find somebody who's studying and be like, oh yeah, here's this interesting thing that this one does. None of them are wrong. And again, I want to couple that with, I think it's important to respect people, you know, if they want to be called something, call them that. If they don't want to be called something, don't call them that. But that's different from, like, you know, this version of language is just objectively better, or it's good English, or it's standard. You know, none of that is even linguistically defined, because it's not real.
How to bring us in for a landing here, I could talk to you for 1,000 years.
Fortunately, I have a podcast, so you can listen to me anytime you want.
Oh, please do. And it is called Lingthusiasm.
Yes, it's called.
I'm going to start listening to this fucking podcast. I mean, I'm sorry that I haven't listened to it so far. This is wonderful stuff.
No, it's fine.
Well, so let me ask this. The sort of linguistics that I never studied any linguistics, but my peripheral understanding of it from other things that I studied was a lot of, like, you know, what is the structure of language in the human mind? And what are the sort of rules that we can intuit about where language comes from? And these sort of much more, you know, psychological, you know, explorations of language. And what you're describing, a lot of the work that you've been describing is very almost sociology. You're talking about the way that people communicate on the internet, like what they want to do, you know, their choice that they make in language, like the way that they use the line breaks, for instance, is like, it sounds like half sociology to me. And so I wonder,
there are for you, there is both psycholinguistics and sociolinguistics.
And
these are two fields that exist.
All right. Okay. So thank you for schooling me on a very elementary part of the field. So I was just asking about the difference between those two extremely broad subfields of linguistics.
Exactly. But linguistics is really exciting for me because it kind of touches everything. You know, there are so many subfields and there are so many different things that it can talk to. And so, like, it's cool that there is both a psycholinguistics that looks at the sort of brain capacity for language and also the sociolinguistics that looks at the, you know, society level, and also things that look at, you know, the sounds of language or the structure of, you know, sentences and these types of things. Like, there are all these different things, and I think it's fun to take this sort of broad tent approach to linguistics and say, how can we understand how language works, whether that's in internet linguistics or whether that's in some of these more cognitive areas, which are also interesting.
Yeah. So what I was wondering is I feel like your part of the field must be incredibly exciting because there's this incredible volume now of written speech and recorded speech that's like orders of magnitude greater than anything that would have existed, you know, a couple decades ago. And you're able to observe it. I'm wondering if that's changing linguistics as a field at all, or if it's shedding any light on older debates, right? About, you know, that in psycholinguistics, a word I just learned.
Well, I mean, one thing that I think is interesting is just sort of the general, you know, both like there's so much language that exists in a sort of searchable form now, which didn't mm-hmm. exist previously. And so you're able to do richer, what they call corpus linguistics, where you look at large corpora of data and you can find out all sorts of interesting things from corpus linguistics. You know, looking at things like, okay, how can we do better computer models of language? So you have computational linguistics. And how can we find better computer models of language, which might tell us something about what is needed for humans in terms of coming up with language? Or how can we, you know, train your phone to talk back to you more and thereby maybe find out some things about the structure of language itself? So I think a lot of areas of linguistics are being touched by technology in some sense. And some of that is like, specifically how we talk online, which is the kind of bit that I'm interested in. But there's also the sort of like, well, you know, can we get computers to do some stuff for us, you know, or can we get computers to, you know, when it comes to trying to make resources available in underrepresented languages. So, you know, some languages don't even have a dictionary, not even like, English has many dictionaries. We have Oxford and Merriam-Webster and these types of things. Some languages haven't had a dictionary made for them at all. And so using technology to even make a dictionary or to make audio recordings in different languages and stuff like that, like all areas of linguistics end up getting touched by, you know, increased advances in audio processing. There's a whole area of linguistics called gesture studies, which looks at how we gesture, obviously.
Cool.
We have a whole episode of Lingthusiasm about, we have several episodes of Lingthusiasm about gesture because my co-host is a gesture linguist. Including a video one where you can actually see the gestures. And because one of the analogies that I like to make is that people are using gestures in a similar way to how we're using emoji in terms of how they combine with the words that you're saying. The neat thing about gesture studies, which has had a tremendous increase in how much it's been studied in the past, you know, couple, you know, probably five or so decades, and you look at that and you think, ah, that's when video recording came in, because it became so much easier to record gestures and pause them and play them back and really do this sort of fine-grained granular analysis once we had even things like VHS tape. So you had some sort of videotape to do that. And of course, it's easier to do that now. I know some sign language linguists that are working with YouTube videos of people signing because you have, you know, you have access to that kind of data as a corpus as well. So the internet is transforming various areas of linguistics, partly because it's this explosion of sort of language data and how we can process it and what we can do with it, which touches on various aspects of how we do language.
Yeah. I mean, even like, you know, AI text generation, right? Like GPT-3, the what it is outputting now. I saw a headline, I didn't read the article, but that a GPT-3 generated piece of text made it to the top of Hacker News, which is like a Reddit type, site, like fooled the user base of that site into like upvoting this piece of AI generated text. And just that is like, wow, what a door to open to like, what the fuck does that mean?
Right. Well, and in some respects, you know, this is where I think knowledge of linguistics is also really useful because, you know, like thinking about things like the Turing test for, you know, have you created a machine that can, you know, fool somebody on the other end of the chatbot to thinking that there's actually a human at the other end?
Yeah.
And that's a linguistic test, right? That's a test of language. You know, it's a test also of kind of knowledge of the world and, you know, you have to say things that don't totally not make sense. But it is ultimately sort of a linguistic test. And the idea of like, if we want our phones to talk back to us or to communicate us with natural language, or if you want something like GPT-2 to generate the sort of language, it's interesting to have this understanding of language from a linguist perspective of like what's been going on there. We also did an interview on Lingthusiasm with Janelle Shane, who does these really fun, weird robot, AI experiments. So she tries to like get robots to generate like ice cream flavors and stuff like this. And they're all like really weird and funny to sort of figure out the problems with AI. So we were able to do a neural network generated episode of the podcast where we fed in the transcripts of all of our previous episodes.
Whoa.
And then we had it spit out like dialogues between me and my co-host and being like, here's what's going on. And then we like read out the best dialogues for like, what has the machine generated? And the thing is like that we were using GPT-2 because GPT-3 didn't exist yet. And the thing is like GPT-2 was able to figure some stuff out. Like it was able to figure out that like my co-host and I take turns talking. It was able to figure out the sort of general tone of the podcast, which is very enthusiastic and like, you know, positive. And like it began a lot of our sentences like, yeah, and, which mm-hmm. I guess is something that we do. Its linguistics was very, very bad.
Yeah.
I'm not really worried about my job being taken by a robot anytime soon because it would like... Well, include some words about linguistics, but they'd be very false.
But well, let me just say, GPT-3 is like a huge advancement over GPT-2 in terms of like how what it spits out. But the other thing that like always is underrated, I think, about those language generation tools, all the stuff we trained an AI to write a Seinfeld episode, yada yada kind of thing. All of those sorts of things are they had an AI spit out a bunch of text and then humans selected the best text and combined right. it. In every single right. case, it's not yeah. the raw output. It's someone who's basically doing magnetic poetry. And then saying, look at the poem my fridge wrote. Right? But in reality, no, you wrote the poem. You used a tool to write something. And then the comedy of it is us imagining that a computer did it all by itself. But in reality, you selected the funniest bits, exactly. which is, as a comedy writer, always bothered me that people are acting like humans aren't creating this comedy.
Yeah, and like we performed the best bits, and then we also released a document that's just like 100 pages of all of the stuff that it generated. So you can mm-hmm. see how... weird the raw output is.
Yeah.
And even that is somewhat curated, but it's, you can see how weird that is. It's kind of like saying like my keyboard wrote this poem because my keyboard had 26 letters and I just combined them.
Right. Exactly. I mean, but you know, that field is moving so fast that, you know, who knows how true that's going to be in a couple of years.
But I think there too, understanding linguistics can be really helpful because if you go back to this sort of socio side, what kinds of English or what kinds of language are available in these sorts of texts? So like GPT-3 is trained on like billions of words of stuff that's been written on the internet. Well, what exists on the internet, right? Like there's a whole lot of English text. It's like if you train it on news sites, it's going to be a certain type of English text. It's not going to be a representation of how English is spoken, which is a lot more diverse than how it tends to get written down. Or mm-hmm. it's going to get trained on like, here's a bunch of Harry Potter fan fiction, which is written in a particular style. And it's hard to make those types of tools for any other language, really, at this point, even like the big languages, like French or Chinese or Spanish or something. But it's hard because you need so much training data to get these kinds of results.
Yeah.
And we just don't have that much written text in really any other language or maybe in many other languages beyond like the top 10. So how do you do this? And like humans don't require this much input in order to start talking. They take quite a lot of input, but like by the time you're two or so, you know, you're talking in sentences. How can you do this with like less input? Because
yeah.
that's where you could get something that might actually work for more languages.
Well, God, I could talk to you for 1,000 years. And I'm loath to even ask you a closing question because we'll be here for another 45 minutes. what do you hope people take away in terms of like their daily use of language?
I think that a lot of people have this sort of fundamental linguistic insecurity of like, you know, maybe I'm not doing it right. Like maybe I'm just constantly saying things that are wrong. You have that sort of red pen hangover. And to be able to think through that in a more reasoned sort of way, you know, if you're not doing a specific person harm, if you're not actively insulting somebody or being rude to somebody, you're fine. You're probably fine. It's okay to wave at the end of your Zoom calls. It's okay to be creative with language and be expressive with language and be doing interesting things with language. Like, you're probably fine. It's okay.
Thank you. That's a wonderful message to end with. Thank you so much, Gretchen, for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
The podcast, again, is called Linkthusiasm. The book is called Because Internet. You are called Gretchen McCulloch. Really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you again to Gretchen McCulloch for coming on the show. Her book, again, is Because Internet, and her podcast is Lingthusiasm. I hope you check them out. That is it for us this week on Factually. If you like the show, hey, send me an email and let me know what you thought about it. If you have any questions for me, feel free to shoot them to factually@adamconover.net. And please, please, please leave us a rating or a review wherever you subscribe. It really does help us out. I want to thank our producers, Dana Wickens and Sam Roudman, our engineers, Brett Morris and Ryan Connor, Andrew WK for our theme song. I've been Adam Conover. You can find me at adamconover.net or at Adam Conover wherever you get your social media. And until next time, we'll see you next week on Factually.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.